The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Good afternoon. I would like for us to start today's exciting panel on the big chill, could you land in jail for covering the news? And we're going to hear certainly from a group of outstanding lawyers and experts on fundamental issues involving freedom of expression. And in the publicity that was distributed in advance, you can see what are some of these issues. Could a newspaper column could damage national security and change lives? What are the legal principles involved? Is it a crime to reveal the name of a CIA agent and so forth? And again, this group is better prepared than anyone to answer these questions. But I wanted to be here not just in my role as a dean of a law school that from time to time comes to things to say, well, thank you for being here and talking a couple of good things about the law school. I wanted to highlight another aspect of this important debate. And that aspect is an aspect involving international relations and the importance that the United States has in the world and in this hemisphere. I was in Jamaica this weekend, Friday and Saturday, and not precisely enjoying the good weather. At the request of the Inter-American Press Association, I went there to defend the newspaper, The Gleaner, which is the most important newspaper in Jamaica. Reason. The Gleaner published a news of the Associated Press saying that a former minister of tourism had gotten kickbacks from companies in the United States and that he was going to be indicted. Well, he was indicted. After a while, he negotiated his way out of the legal mess in which he found himself. But the issue is the following. The Gleaner had to pay $500,000 British pounds in penalties for libel. The British have very serious libel laws. The case went all the way to the Privy Council, Jamaica Resorts under the Privy Council in London. Well, Jamaica has ratified the American Convention on Human Rights. The American Convention under Article 13 prohibits prior censorship and allows for subsequent liability. But that subsequent liability needs to satisfy very stringent tests of proportionality, need, and so forth and so on. Also, under the jurisprudence developed by the Inter-American Commission and Court, these requirements for subsequent liability, among other things, need to satisfy the test of real malice that I'm sure all of you know, plus other very important legal principles. These legal principles are very important, in particularly to the hemisphere, where the most important job for former presidents is to stay out of jail because of corruption. You know, when we have to invite a former president of the region to come here, we have tremendous difficulties because out of 10, 8 are in jail or in the way to jail or they cannot leave the country and so forth. So I met with the Attorney General of Jamaica and I said, you have to understand, we want you not to be in jail. I mean, really, it's a prophylactic measure. You should see this as allies. And in particular, when the purpose of, when you are in the public service, you are more exposed than other people to criticism and to scrutiny and so forth. Well, again, this hemisphere is full with violations of the freedom of expression, the right to freedom of expression. Almost 200 journalists have been killed during the last 10 years. And it's important to mention 10 years because this is when democracy was, or free elections were reestablished in the region. Out of 34, five countries, 34, all of them but Cuba have free elections. So, but there are weak judiciaries, weak congresses, and really the check and balances depends on a very powerful press that will communicate to people what's going on. And I'm proud to say that we see a movement in that direction through the Inter-American Commission and the Inter-American Court. Also, President Clinton spearheaded some years ago an effort by all the presidents of the region to establish a special rapporteur on freedom of expression. And since then, it's a permanent position that highlights the importance for the expansion of democracy of this fundamental right. And what I wanted to say today is that what happens in the United States is very important, because it could tip, the balance in a different direction. What the United States does is not only important for the United States, it has a tremendous importance for the 800 million men and women who live in this hemisphere and in the world. So in addition to the responsibilities that we all have in terms of the rule of law and the promotion of fundamental values here, let us not forget also that what is being decided today will have an impact in international relations and in the way in which men and women live their lives everywhere in the world. And I think that is, for me, a former president of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, a very important topic due to the reasons that you can imagine. So, I think it's very difficult to develop a society that is free and where people can develop themselves to the limit of their potential in a world where we would have dictatorship or fundamentalism. At the same time, if in the United States we have this type of issues that will fuel forces that are not precisely for the favor of democracy and the rule of law. So I wanted to put a few words in terms of that issue that was not raised here. I will tell you that there are hundreds of cases now relating freedom of expression, and all of us are looking at what's going to happen here because of its tremendous importance. I also wanted to say that this law school is proud to be to offer a space for the discussion of fundamental issues of our time. We have strong, deeply held values, and we enter into that debate not in a neutral sense, but we want to be a space where people can express their ideas fully. And just to have discussions where we have only the convinced, not only is boring, doesn't achieve anything. So we're eager to exchange views with everyone, including those who have different values. The values are valid. That means that people have different opinions and different thoughts. But an apparent neutrality doesn't get anywhere. This reification has been identified conceptually in the past. We have a position as everyone else. Nobody came from the moon here. But the idea is really to have the respect for the views of everyone and to have a thorough and interesting exchange of views. And we aspire to become a place where we do that. In this school, we have over 50 conferences per year, attracting more than 7,000 people. And we see this as part of our role, the role to bring a legal perspective to important issues facing the nation, the community, and the world. Well, without further ado, I want to welcome you into our institution and thank the student society that organized this. I recognize all of you as a dean. Also, I want to recognize Ron Alam, who is here and also has been very loyal with our institution all the time, and thank you for your participation.
My pleasure.
And thank you all for being in our law school. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Dean Grossman. Good afternoon. I'm Ronald Karp, and along with Dave Bartlett, I'm going to be co-moderator of this program today. And because it's being videotaped and taped from what I'm told is a pod broadcast, I would ask everyone to turn off their cell phones. Let me just briefly introduce our panelists, and then each of them will come up and talk with you, and then we'll all be happy to answer as many questions as you have. First, we have Christopher Wolf, who's going to be first up on the batting order, who is a partner at the Washington office of Proskauer and Rose. Chris also happens to represent Ambassador Wilson and Valerie Plame. Most of you know that Ms. Plame was outed by Robert Novak in one of his columns, and that started this whole controversy. And as we speak today, Judith Miller a reporter for the New York Times, sits in jail as a result of her covering that story, even though she never wrote a piece about it at all. We then have Professor Jamie Raskin, who I know is well known to all of you in this room, one of the most brilliant constitutional minds in this country. I had the great fortune of being on a legal team with him when we represented Chief Moose in his First Amendment battle to get his book published. I can't wait to hear what Professor Raskin has to say about these issues. Ford Rowan, who is a former NBC News correspondent and a lawyer as well. And Mr. Rowan runs as a principal in a company called Rowan and Blewett, and they counsel clients who are in the eye of a media storm, which is we're going to get into in great detail today. Neil Puckett, talk about clients in the eye of a media storm. Neil Puckett is a well-known defense lawyer. He most recently defended General Karpinski in the Abu Ghraib scandal, and that was a media storm that never seemed to end, and I think it's finally over. And last but not least, my co-moderator, David Bartlett, who has been on every side of this First Amendment issue. David has been a media reporter. He's been a print reporter. He has managed reporters. He ran the NBC radio network, so he's managed news reporters. And now, with Ford Rowan, he counsels people who are in the middle of media storms. And I just want to say at the outset that Frank Rich of the New York Times had a wonderful piece about a year ago saying that nobody handles life in a media storm. Even the New York Times, when they had the Jason Blair controversy, couldn't handle it. And many of the editors, he pointed out, looked like fools doing this perp walk up Broadway. CBS couldn't handle it during the 60 Minutes scandal. And so no one could really handle it. But we're going to look at the First Amendment today through several prisms, from the tension that a reporter has in getting the story right to the extra pressure now of not only getting the story right, but will I end up in jail if I cover this too aggressively? Will I end up in jail if I give up some sources? We're also going to look at the First Amendment from the standpoint of lawyers who have to represent people in the eye of a media storm and how they should best respond to it. So I think that by the end of the day, we will have covered this issue from every angle, from the reporter's angle, from the lawyer's angle, and we're going to get some constitutional law perspectives on it. And then at the end of our seminar at 6 o'clock, we are invited to the Dean's Suite for some refreshments and a reception, and we would ask all of you to join us. So without further ado, let me welcome Christopher Wolfe.
Thanks very much, Ron. It is in fact true that I am a lawyer for Joe Wilson and Valerie Wilson. She came to be called Valerie Plame, but in fact is known as Valerie Wilson. But more fundamentally, I am their friend, and I'm their neighbor. As a lawyer, I've been telling them a little bit about the grand jury and what's going on there, a little bit about reporters' privilege, explaining to them sort of the legal niceties, but they have no legal exposure, and right now they have no legal claim, although obviously they might eventually once the grand jury is finished their work. But they came to me because my practice is in the area of privacy, and if there's anyone who's had their privacy invaded, it's Valerie Wilson. We moved in about the same time. We lived not far from here down Foxhall Road. Won't give you the exact address.
It's a matter of privacy.
Exactly. Mm. Although it's been on the Internet, it's been on Google after the Robert Novak column. But we moved in next door to each other about the same time. In fact, the same builder built our houses, so we would gripe together about all the defects and shoddy workmanship. And when we first met, Joe introduced himself as a former ambassador to a number of African countries, the former advisor to President Clinton on Africa and the National Security Council. And Valerie essentially mumbled something about being a consultant, which, as you know, in Washington, effectively means you're out of work or you're between engagements. And when you hear that, at least when I hear that, I kind of back off. I don't want to press. I don't want to be too rude. And we left it at that. And occasionally she would go, I know she'd go away on trips, but it was quite vague, and we really didn't push it. And I told her I was a lawyer, and that's not so interesting in Washington either. But I guess my story starts on July 4th, 2003. Together, the Wilsons and we walked down to MacArthur Boulevard, where there's this kind of quaint New England-style 4th of July parade. Those of you who live around here may have seen that. And it's really a very nice event. It was the run-up to the 2004 election. There were various candidates' representatives there, and the Dean contingent comes marching down MacArthur Boulevard. And we hear cheering, sort of abnormal cheering, a little bit down the street. And it turns out it was Karl Rove saying, yeah, that's our guy, that's who we want, presumably thinking that that would be a lie-down if Dean had been nominated. Who knows whether that would have been the case. We thought that was a little odd. As we were walking back, the subject of the war in Iraq came up, because at that point it was only a few months old. And Joe said to me, I want you to read something that I've written. And at that point, I really had no idea of Joe's involvement in anything having to do with Iraq. I knew he, too, was a consultant with an international business consulting firm, and I didn't push there too hard either. They were just nice neighbors. We shared cookouts. Their three-year-olds called me Wolfie, notwithstanding their parents asking them to call me Mr. Wolf. And there it lay until July 4th, when Joe showed me an article called What I Didn't Find in Africa, which was to be published the following Sunday in the New York Times op-ed section, which for the first time called into question the administration's rationale for going to war, and in particular the claims that were repeatedly made, including in the now famous or infamous 16 words in the State of the Union, that Iraq had been trying to obtain uranium from Niger. What the op-ed recounted, as you may now know, is that those claims were false, that Joe had gone on a mission on behalf of the CIA, a mission that was prompted originally by an inquiry from the Office of the Vice President, and he reported he had asked the administration to correct its claim, but when it became clear that it appeared, at least to him, that the claim was based on his report, he had to go public. And that certainly was news, and I knew it would be news, and it was when it was published, and it created some consternation. Joe went on Meet the Press. Immediately thereafter, the administration retracted the 16 words, and as you probably know, this administration doesn't retract anything. And so that was significant news, too. And so there it lay for about a week, and the following Monday, the 14th, I think it was, I went out and had breakfast on my deck, which I occasionally do in nice weather. And I opened the Washington Post, and there was Robert Novak's column, and I dropped my spoonful of life cereal when I read that my next-door neighbor was a spy. And according to Robert Novak, she engineered Joe Wilson's trip to Africa, which later turned out, or we now know, those of us who've studied it carefully, is not the case, but in any event is irrelevant. Joe happened to walk out at that moment, and I said, Joe, what is this all about? And he basically said, shh, shh. And he looked absolutely chagrined. As it turned out, it was the first time in Valerie's then 17 years or 16 years of service as a NOC, an unofficial cover, non-official cover, CIA agent, that her identity had been revealed. And her life took a sudden change, sudden and drastic change at that point. Her career was certainly over, the career that she had known and trained for. She was apparently first in her class in training with an AK-47, was working on weapons of mass destruction, and not a relevant task to what the country was going through at the time. It certainly put in jeopardy all of her contacts over the 16 or 17 years she had been in that position all over the world. It even put in jeopardy her family and herself, and maybe even her next-door neighbor, who knows. But there are enough crazies out there who think the CIA planted a radio receiver in their head or what have you, and when they can personify the CIA in someone, they sometimes do some terrible things. We remember the attack on Cambridge Road on CIA officials. So it really was a horrible thing for Valerie Wilson, for her family, for her contacts, for her career, but it was also a horrible thing for our country. And that is something that the CIA deliberated for a few months. By the way, the outing, as it's come to be known, was a little bit of news at the time. People thought it was odd that someone's wife would be dragged into the public square in connection with something that Joe Wilson had said. It really was not relevant, never has been. The merits of what he said were conceded by the White House, that there was no basis for the 16 words in the State of the Union. To fast forward a little bit, because I know we want to get to a lot of the legal issues, in September, the CIA referred this revelation that Robert Novak had made to the Justice Department for investigation under the Intelligence Identities Act of 1982, a law that was passed following a pattern of outings of CIA agents by Philip Agee at the time, and a law that explicitly exempts people like Robert Novak. It has a freedom of the press element built into it. But it does make it a crime, a federal crime, for someone to knowingly out and knowingly identify a covert agent whom they knew the CIA at the time was trying to protect, his identity they were trying to protect. And a grand jury was convened, and in December of 2003, Attorney General Ashcroft finally recused himself. He clearly had some interest in the investigation, since the people being investigated were his political allies in the White House. And a special prosecutor, Pat Fitzgerald, the U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Illinois, was appointed to investigate. And investigate he has up until this moment. The grand jury is still sitting. It expires next month. Big question as to whether or not it will be renewed. And he's been investigating aggressively, up to and including subpoenaing reporters. Now, why has he done that? He's done that because the act which constituted the potential violation of the Intelligence Identities Protection Act was leaking Valerie Wilson's identity, blowing her cover, outing her to a reporter. And as you've all read, I'm sure, that story was shopped around by two senior administration officials, according to Robert Novak in his own column. So two very highly placed people in the Bush administration, we think in retaliation for Joe blowing the whistle on the uranium claim, blew the cover of a national intelligence officer, an undercover intelligence officer. Injuring the national security of the United States, as was reflected by the finding of even the most vigorous First Amendment proponents in the D.C. Circuit opinion, which upheld the subpoenas to the reporters. So the issue, I think, if I can frame the issue for the panel, and they'll frame it for themselves, I'm sure, as they get up here, is this the kind of leak that we want to protect? When we think about leaks, we think about Watergate, blowing the whistle on wrongdoing in the White House in that case. And we think about people whose identity needs to be protected because if it wasn't protected, wrongdoing would not be uncovered. They wouldn't come forward and speak to reporters. And we want reporters to be able to keep those promises of confidentiality. Do we want to allow reporters to keep promises of confidentiality to administration officials whose very acts themselves may be violations of law? And whether they're violations of law or not, were intended to be political payback against a critic of the administration. So let me frame it that way, if I can, to be perhaps controversial. And let me stop there, and I guess I'm going to rejoin the discussion, Ron, later on.
Right. Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chris. Our next panelist is your constitutional law professor, and I'd like to thank my constitutional law professor as well, Jamin Raskin, who is most recently covering the Roberts confirmation hearings for NPR. But I keep thinking that in a really perfect world, if we wanted these hearings to be riveting, the senators who spent about 75% of their time asking questions would have hired Professor Raskin as special counsel and let him ask the questions. Then we would have had some really wonderful hearings. Professor Raskin?
Ron, thank you for that vote of confidence. I may have actually fed a couple of questions in there, but I'm not leaking anything today. But I have no direct involvement in this case. I may be the only person here who has no direct involvement in the case. So, but my role is a simple one. I just want to lay out what the current constitutional precedent and framework is for analyzing the question of what happens when a reporter gets subpoenaed by a grand jury for his or her notes that were undertaken on a confidential basis. As Chris said, there's a federal law which makes it a crime for government officials to divulge the identity of a CIA agent. There is a scienter requirement in this law, meaning that there must be knowledge that the person actually is or still is a CIA agent, and there are at least some suggestions that that's the holdup in there being indictments from this grand jury in the Valerie Plame affair. You know, can it be proven that Karl Rove, for example, actually had knowledge that she was still in the CIA? And of course, to hear Chris tell it, it shouldn't have been a mystery to anyone who was in the know that she was in the CIA, that she in fact was still an undercover knock, as you put it. In any event, that's the criminal law that's in play in this case. Now, the leading Supreme Court precedent is Brandsburg versus Hayes, which was decided in 1972. It was an interesting case where the court consolidated several different lower court decisions, all involving a similar scheme, which was a reporter who had gone undercover with the agreement of people who were basically violating the law, and by virtue of being undercover and present, were able to tell a good story. And so the name petitioner here, Brandsburg, was a reporter in Kentucky who'd written a series of articles about local drug dealers and how they made hashish and how they prepared marijuana for sale and so on. And when he was subpoenaed by the grand jury, he refused to testify on the grounds that he had been there as a guest, essentially, of the drug dealers and had agreed not to turn over any information. And so he couldn't do it as an aspect of his professional code. And it was pretty much the same thing with a Massachusetts TV newsman reporter and a New York Times reporter, both of whom had been invited on a confidential basis to travel with the Black Panthers or to be at Black Panthers meetings. Both of them also had been subjects of grand jury subpoenas. Both of them said they could not testify consistent with agreements that they had with the subjects of their articles. So the question then was fairly posed: can a grand jury force a reporter to testify about information that he or she has gotten by virtue of a confidentiality agreement with a subject in a story? And it was a 5-4 decision, but the majority, with Justice White writing the opinion for himself and three other justices, with a concurrence by Justice Powell, which I'll discuss in a moment, but the four justices who were part of the majority signed on to White's opinion, saying, look, reporters are no differently situated than any other U.S. citizen, and all of us, as a matter of constitutional and common law, owe the sovereign our honest, truthful testimony about any information that we have that may relate to a criminal prosecution. After all, we know that the First Amendment gives people a right against compelled speech. Ordinarily, the government can't force people to speak, at least against conscience. That's the meaning of West Virginia versus Barnett and a series of other cases like that, Woolley versus Maynard. But an exception to that rule against compelled speech is the government can compel you to speak in court about a matter that is subject of criminal prosecution. And the court said that reporters who have access to information that information that's of relevance to criminal prosecution are no differently situated than anybody else. And so the court acknowledged that certain states had passed reporter shield laws to shield them from such grand jury subpoenas, but they said that's not a constitutional rule, and the court declined to extend a testimonial privilege on a constitutional basis under the Free Press Clause to reporters. Justice White pointed out that this would be chilling to reporters only with respect to confidentiality agreements that relate to information about criminal things, about criminal information. But there, Justice White said, the public interest in obtaining this information was overwhelming compared to a less weighty right that the reporters had. And then I think in perhaps the most important argument, or at least I think it becomes much more important today, Justice White said, beyond the fact that the public interest overrides the press interest, who's the press anyway? And when he was writing the decision, he said, you know, anybody with carbon paper and a mimeograph machine can be the press. And there are lots of cases, certainly recently, where the Supreme Court has invoked Tom Paine and the authors of the Federalist Papers, Publius and so on, for the proposition that in America, to have a pen and a piece of paper is to be part of the press. That is, you're a pamphleteer and you can go out and pass your stuff around. And I think that argument has only grown more forceful with the advent of the internet. And Justice White also said, with some perceptiveness, it's unclear why this right should be extended to reporters, say, and not, for example, to academics, political scientists, reporters, other people who go out and get information from people. Now, he didn't acknowledge the possible force of a rejoinder, which is that there is a clause in the Constitution that calls for freedom of the press separate from freedom of speech, which I think is generally the Achilles heel of the majority opinion, that it doesn't really acknowledge any weight to the fact that we do have an independent free press clause, and so there's no explanation of what it really means, and this opinion kind of turns it into surplusage or a kind of redundancy because of the freedom of speech. In any event, White ends up by saying, we're going to let the states and Congress deal with this. If they want to establish a balancing test, a balancing mechanism to go on a case-by-case basis, fine, but we're not going to force them to do so as a matter of constitutional interpretation. Now, Justice Powell, in his concurrence, moved closer to that position, saying that on his view, if the reporter is called upon to give information bearing only a remote and tenuous relationship to the subject of the investigation, or if he has some other reason to believe that his testimony implicates confidential source relationships without a legitimate need of law enforcement, he will have access to the court on a motion to quash. And so the suggestion there is that even under the general ruling that there's no absolute testimonial privilege attendant to the reporters, a motion would lie if the reporter thinks either there's no real compelling need for it, or if the information that is secret and held confidential really only has some tangential bearing on the case. But nonetheless, Powell concurred, and so that created the five-justice majority. Now, in terms of the dissenters, Justice Douglas took the position that there's an absolute First Amendment a basis for testimonial privilege. He anchored this first in the notion that every citizen is entitled to seek out his or her own access to the truth, okay, a sort of X-Files image of people going out and finding out whatever they can, and the government can't force you to talk about it, even if the government wants that information for a prosecution. He also linked the constitutional privilege that he envisioned to the traditional Michael John argument about democratic self-government as being the heart of the First Amendment, and they are argued that the people need to get this information through the press. The other dissenters were Marshall and Brennan and Stewart, and Stewart wrote an opinion where he said, essentially, we've got to grant some real purchase to the free press clause, and the press plays a very strong role in our democracy, something like a fourth branch of government. And if it's not there to operate as a kind of institutionalized check and balance, the other branches are going to get away from us. The strongest point I think that Justice Stewart made was, what about the example, and this obviously doesn't apply to the current case we're talking about, but what about the case of someone who's in a government agency or the Pentagon, I think maybe he was thinking about the My Lai massacre. What about someone who's a whistleblower and wants to remain anonymous and tells a reporter, check out the corruption in this agency, whatever, and then the government embarks upon an investigation, a grand jury's impaneled, and then the reporter's notes are subpoenaed, and now the person who was the anonymous whistleblower suddenly gets outed. So if you want to be a whistleblower, you in effect have to become Deep Throat. You have to do it in a completely secretive way, actually keeping your identity even secret from the reporters themselves, because the reporters will have to testify at the pain of going to jail. Well, so where are we today? Well, this is still the law, and I think it's very unlikely that the Supreme Court is going to change it. The question of what's the media has become even more problematic today than it was when Justice White was first writing, precisely because we have thousands or perhaps tens of thousands of bloggers, and anybody can go online and write a report that is instantly available to the whole world. So everybody is theoretically Tom Paine. And so if you want to argue for a constitutional privilege attendant just to the news media, somehow you've got to define what that is. But it's very hard to define the news media in a non-question-begging way, or at least one that doesn't lapse into a really painful elitism about who gets to be the media and who's not the media. So I would think the best bet is to go for these kinds of statutory balancing solutions to the problem, perhaps focused on the public interest whistleblower, who I think does make a much more sympathetic candidate for constitutional protection than someone like Karl Rove, who, if what we've read turns out to be true, and we don't know whether it is, but he was not a whistleblower who was acting in the interest of vindicating the public's right to know about what's going on with government. On the contrary, he was acting, as a political operative, attempting to not blow the whistle on something illicit going on in the government, but to out someone who was doing her job in the interest of discrediting the opponents of a particular administration policy. So the issues that are raised are obviously profound, and even if you generally accept the constitutional paradigm as it has evolved here, your heart has to go out to Judith Miller, who's spending time in jail for not giving up her sources. On the other hand, I think you got to feel sorry for a lot of people who are in jail. And there are lots of people who've refused to turn state's evidence who aren't reporters, who are also thrown in jail. And so one has to ask whether our compassion goes out to them as well. But I'm very eager to hear what the lawyers who are deeply involved in the case have to say. Thanks.
Thank you. Professor Eskin, before you leave the podium, I'm curious as to your thoughts on Chris's question as to whether or not somebody who outs a CIA agent, as when I read the Novak story, I wondered what was so newsworthy about pointing out that she was a CIA agent. It seemed like it was a direct hit, a political hit, and it was payback. I couldn't figure out what the newsworthy part of the story was that she was an agent. And so I'm curious as to what your thoughts are of protecting someone who leaks, in effect, a national security, becomes a national security issue.
Yeah. Well, I think that the law that prevents government officials from outing CIA agents is a clearly constitutional law. And there was a prior Supreme Court decision relating to a CIA agent named Frank Snepp, who signed a contract saying, I'm not going to release or publish any information relating to anything I've done in the CIA without getting the CIA's approval. And then he wrote a book about the Vietnam War and the CIA's role in it. And although I think the court determined that there was no information that was actually confidential that was in the book, still he had to be bound by his agreement not to talk. And again, he, I think, makes a far more sympathetic plaintiff, because at this point he's a citizen and he's talking about a matter of public interest and public concern. But this, I think the Supreme Court said, look, you can sign away your First Amendment rights to that extent. And I think that people who enter into government service, at the very least, can, in essence, sign away their right to out people who are undercover as police officers or as CIA agents, at least to the extent that we have them. Now, I think Senator Moynihan, towards the end of his life, was moving to the position that, hey, we should abolish the CIA. We don't need it anymore. It's not doing a good job. And we've just witnessed two spectacular failures of intelligence, one, 9/11, and two, in Iraq. You know, we're spending billions and billions of dollars to get back information that is useless to us. You know, and so I think there is an argument that in a democracy, maybe people shouldn't be undercover agents. But if we're going to have them, I think it's legitimate to say that at least people in government can't out them. I don't know whether you could say that U.S. citizens who come into possession of that information, like Matt Cooper or Judith Miller, can go to jail for publishing it. I sort of doubt that. So I think that the burden really is upon people in the government to maintain their pact of silence, as long as we're going to keep that as a public policy. So.
Thank you. Chris, before we move on, do you have any last thoughts on that issue?
Well, there is a scenario in which I think a reporter could go to jail for violating that statute, and that is if there's a pattern, if really that reporter embarks on outing CIA agents based on leaks that the government might provide. But the statute, I think, provides ample protection for reporters. But it does impose an obligation on government officials. And there are lots of other statutes. Everybody's been focusing on this one because I think this was the basis of the referral to the Department of Justice. But when you get in a senior government position, you have an obligation to protect classified information. And the defense, gee, I didn't know, doesn't wash and shouldn't wash because there is an obligation to look before you speak. And the trouble with what Karl Rove did is that he was, at the very least, reckless, and perhaps more than that. The grand jury is looking at that. But there, even if, I mean, his rationale, as I understand it, is that, you know, who is this Joe Wilson? He was a second-level ambassador whose own wife had to get him this job. They weren't quibbling with the information again. They conceded the information, but they somehow were arguing in a Schwarzenegger-like way. He was a girly man because he had to rely on his wife. For a job that, by the way, didn't pay anything. It was a pro bono assignment and took him away from his infant twins. It's been proven totally false and it's irrelevant, but that was his motivation. There was no overriding national interest for him to get that message out without first looking at who this person was and whether the government and the national security interests would be injured before playing around with her releasing her identity.
Yeah.
If I could interject something... for what it's worth, we don't know yet that it was Karl Rove. So I think we need to be careful. That's what is essentially being investigated.
Sure. Everything we know is from leaks, but we've heard Matt Cooper, was one of the first people reporting on it, say that he heard it first from Karl Rove.
Okay.
So there's not a lot of doubt about that.
Well, then the other element, probably the more important one, perhaps, is that Novak subsequently has said, presumably in his own defense, although I'm not sure he needs one, legally anyway, that it was at least within the elite media and government circles that he travels fairly well known that Valerie Plame worked for the CIA.
And that, I will tell you...
That wasn't news.
I will tell you on the record right here, and whoever asked, that's a complete fabrication.
Dispute that.
One that was, by the way... publicized by the Washington Times, allegedly based on a report by one of their reporters who concluded just the contrary. There's absolutely nothing to that.
Then how come, and I'm asking as somebody who essentially has no factual predicate for any of this, I'm just a reader like everybody else, how come Novak didn't treat that little morsel as a bigger news story? He threw it away in a column. If it was that big a revelation, if it was that good and juicy a leak, if I were Bob Novak, I would have probably led the piece with it.
He published it in his column, which is, you know, prominently republished in newspapers around the country. He says it was an aside. The point is, it was published, and it then blew her cover. And so it doesn't matter whether it was, he might have buried the lead, and as a journalist, that wasn't the greatest way to write the column. But it was in the column.
And well, I'm not disputing the fact, and you know, I'm not disposed or don't have the capacity to dispute the legal issue either, as far as that goes. It just, as a recovering journalist, I'm just curious about kind of trying to deconstruct the thought process of the columnist.
Sure, and
walking the cat back.
Well, the additional
the additional factor,
and it would be great to hear Bob Novak talk about this, other than the little snippets that he throws out there, but he refuses to. In fact, he left the set of a TV show when the topic was about to come up, if you recall. But he was told by the CIA twice, please don't go with the story. And the CIA has to walk a fine line. They can't confirm the identity of the agent,
right,
but they can say, please don't go with this story. So when the CIA says that to a journalist, and that's the topic for this panel, I guess, shouldn't the journalist defer to the national interest judgment, national security judgment of the CIA in those circumstances?
Ah, well, that raises an interesting point.
And haven't they in the past?
Well, they
have at times, and they haven't at times.
Yeah, and I don't know whether they need to accede to the request, but it does go to the question of what his state of mind was and what he knew, if the CIA is telling him not to run with it. I mean, but what you're asking is interesting as a matter of journalism, but as a matter of law, that strikes me like someone who's picked up for shoplifting, whose defense is, well, if I was really guilty, I would have robbed a bank.
Yeah.
I mean,
right.
So, all right. I mean, my excuse runs.
It's strictly a journalistic question.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think an important one, because I can answer from a journalistic perspective, I can answer your question about should you automatically trust or even put weight in something the CIA says by way of requesting that you not reveal something. And I would come down absolutely, positively in the negative. Matter of fact, in today's environment and on today's facts, and we see it over and over again, because if the CIA tells you something is true, it probably isn't.
It might be a slam dunk.
It might be. And I think a journalist who simply accepts the word of the CIA, however heartfelt and impassioned the request might be, would be irresponsible at worst.
But I would differ with you on the issue of disclosing the identity of a knock. If it has to do with whether a certain fact is true or not, the CIA leads you in one direction, you certainly have an obligation as a journalist to report if you believe the facts are otherwise. This has to do with really something fundamental to our national security, and that is the status of an undercover agent. I think most journalists would abide by a request not to disclose that identity.
Oh, I know plenty who have, but I know for the most part they are nervous about that because you don't know what the motivation is. I mean, motivation is a whole lot harder to discern.
Yeah, but you knew what the motivation
state of mind is harder to discern than
you knew
than
what
fact.
The motivation of the leakers were here, and the leakers were to get even with Joe, right, or at least to diminish his credibility. And I think that should color whether or not you
well, that's one
to the CIA
that's one assertion. I mean, I'm not sure that's universally agreed to. It's
well, I noticed one interesting thing when Novak was on Meet the Press, his excuse for publishing this, when they asked him, well, why don't you just adhere to the CIA telling you not to do it? His excuse was, well, everybody in Washington knows about it.
Yeah, yeah.
He's just making that up.
And I'm thinking that here, her next-door neighbor, who's also her lawyer, doesn't know about it. And I'm willing to bet if you stopped 100 people on the steps of Capitol Hill and asked them who Valerie Plame was or Valerie Wilson, they wouldn't know who she was. So his concept that he didn't really out somebody that was known all over town seems to be totally preposterous. Let's move on to one other angle on this whole issue, and that is, what is it like when you are in the eye of a media storm? I know we have some embryonic lawyers out here in the audience, and one day you're going to be representing somebody who is in the eye of a media storm, and we're going to focus a little bit on what that is like, and I'm going to bring Neil Puckett up in a second, but let me give you my own perspective, and I went through this, and fortunately I had Professor Raskin on my legal team when we represented Chief Moose. Every single morning that I came into work, I had at least 15 or 20 messages from the Today Show and every morning show and every newspaper in the country wanting to talk about the Moose case. It never went away. We had at one point a Washington Post reporter camping in our law firm's reception area. The Mooses had a Washington Post reporter, and there was also camera crews camping outside their house. And it was a never-ending story. And I finally just stopped answering the phone. I remember one night I was out shopping at the Giant, and the Post reporter called up and insisted on talking to me, and my wife said he's at the Giant. He didn't believe it. But finally, the next morning, he called me and said, you know, I don't want to be intruding on your privacy and calling and bugging your wife. He said, but you have to understand something. As a reporter, I am under an incredible amount of pressure to write about this every day. And the Post is going to write about this every day. And if you want to be part of the story, you should talk with us. And if you don't want to be part of the story, don't be complaining about the fact that that you weren't in it. And by the way, the implication was, even if you don't talk to us, you're going to be in the story every day because it's going to say, you know, Ronald Karp was called and refused to return our phone calls. There was a moment, and I'm curious as to how Neil lived with this, but there was a moment, I don't know if any of you watched The Sopranos, but when Tony Soprano comes out in the morning and walks down the driveway to get the paper in his bathrobe, I remember in the heat of the story coming down my driveway in my bathroom at 6:30 when you heard the Post hit the pavement, dreading picking up that paper, just dreading it because you couldn't tell what angle the Post was going to have that morning. You couldn't tell if you talked to the reporter for 20 minutes what line they were going to put in there, how foolish we were going to look, or whether there would be something totally preposterous. It was just a never-ending constant barrage, and then suddenly we settled the case, and the news was no more, and they were off to the next story, and the media storm ended, as all of them hopefully do. Well, Neil Puckett was faced with representing General Karpinski in probably one of the biggest scandals since the Iraq War started, maybe the biggest one, the Abu Ghraib scandal, and he's here to talk about what his life was like and what it's like when you're representing somebody in the middle of that. Neil?
Thanks, Ron. Well, I'm Neil Puckett. I'm a retired Marine Corps military judge. I practice in Alexandria, Virginia, out of Alexandria, Virginia. I only do court-martial work. That's all I do. And I stay plenty busy. I joke about the fact that as long as there are Marines, I will have an income. But I want to tell you briefly, the way I fit into this discussion today is not because I know Judith Miller, except to the extent that I can see where she now lives from my bedroom, which I think is kind of neat. I live across from the federal courthouse in Alexandria, and the jail's just a few blocks from that. So I think about her from time to time as I'm stretching and looking out on my domain and have all this freedom, and she has none. But I pick up the phone all the time, and I get calls from moms, dads, wives, husbands of service members who are in trouble. They find me on the internet because of what I do. And Mrs. West was on the phone. I don't know if you remember the case of Lieutenant Colonel Alan West back in 2003. He's the battalion commander who found out about a plot to assassinate him and his men in Iraq. Back in the fall of 2003, and the interrogators weren't getting any results from the people they rounded up that were involved, the particular policemen. So he took matters into his own hands. He went down to the interrogation facility, grabbed the guy, grabbed the guy, took him outside, performed a mock execution, and said, you know, if you don't tell me what I want to know, I'm going to kill you, and then he fired a pistol next to his head. Not an authorized interrogation procedure, just, you know, for future reference. But he knew that. But he did it on purpose because time was short. The assassination attempt, the ambush, was supposed to happen the next day. And he got the information he needed. They rounded up the other people involved, and the best we can tell, they shut everything down. But I got this call from his wife saying, will you represent my husband? What's the situation? Well, she explained it briefly. Got him on the phone from Iraq. I was in Omaha at the time, living in Omaha. And she said, just one question, will you go to Iraq to defend him? And I said, well, I'm a Marine. I go where I'm told. It doesn't matter. So in the meantime, I had a case in Japan. So I went off to Japan. I came back, turn my phone on. I didn't have an international phone at the time. Turn my phone on. There were 50 voicemails for me. You know, I didn't know this guy. Nobody knew this guy. But while I was gone for a week, somebody called the O'Reilly Factor about his situation because he was 2 weeks short of his retirement eligibility. And the Army said, you can either resign effective immediately or we're going to prosecute you. And to this day, I can't figure out, well, is this serious enough to prosecute or can we just let him off the hook without prosecution? They never quite, they wanted to have it sort of both ways. Well, O'Reilly got upset about that. Other news outlets got upset about that. Everybody called me and wanted to talk. I'd never had such a big media case. But the way I fit into this discussion today is sometimes access to the media is very important to my client. A group of a dozen or so congressmen and senators signed a letter to the Secretary of the Army saying, what the heck you doing to this guy? Why don't you intervene and drop charges? He was only doing what he had to do in combat. It's a combat situation. Rules are flexible, that sort of thing. A lot of political pressure was brought to bear. A lot of public pressure was brought to bear. Most people asked about this would say, hey, it's an ugly war. They're trying to kill us. He got information. He didn't kill anybody. He didn't chop off anybody's head. So what's the big deal? That really helped me. There are other times when the media is not in your client's best interest, and you'd rather they go away. Sometimes, as Ron was talking about, I had a child molestation case back in December. Didn't want any media coverage of that. I had a very ugly assault case, attempted murder case, where my client bit off the nose of a young sailor when he savagely attacked her in Thailand because he's sort of mentally ill. Didn't want any media coverage of that. But there are times when you want media coverage, you want access to the media, and there are times when it's very important that that promise of confidentiality comes with it. Sometimes I have information that I'm bound not to make public for ethical reasons for my state bar. The military court-martial process doesn't allow us basically to go public with any information that's going to be subject to the court-martial until it becomes evidence in the court-martial. But what rules apply to the client? And what rules apply to the client's family? The reason you know about the Taguba report from the Abu Ghraib situation is because the family of a staff sergeant who later was convicted and actually pled guilty, the family of that guy had a copy from him and released it to the media, released it to Cy Hirsch. And that's how you know about the Taguba report, because it was classified. Now, it was erroneously classified because the only little sections that were classified were the descriptions of what the soldiers were doing to the detainees in Abu Ghraib, which isn't classified. It's just ugly. But there was no reason to classify it. So anyway, I did the Al West case. Lots of media attention. It was on all the major news outlets. It's 2003. If you don't follow military issues, you might never notice it. However, that experience served me very well, because when I was in Kuwait doing yet another case in Operation Iraqi Freedom, I got a call from a brigadier general whom I'd never met, who said, "Can you come over and talk to me? I heard you're in the area. I remember you from the Al West case." So I went over and met Brigadier General Janis Karpinski back in March of 2004, before the May CBS 60 Minutes revelation of the investigation. And she began to tell me a story about how she commanded Abu Ghraib. Never heard of Abu Ghraib. I got to read the Taguba report. I found out that there were 6 soldiers in an awful lot of trouble. And she was concerned because she was the subject of the investigation. And it was a little unfair because General Sanchez, who was in command at the time, saw these pictures. He was presented with these pictures. And his first question was, who do these soldiers belong to? Oh, well, they belong to the Reserve Brigade, Brigadier General Karpinski's unit. Oh, okay. Well, the two of them had not gotten along since she got in country. She was the first female, American female general to ever command troops in combat. You'll read about that in her book, which comes out this fall. And he would never give her any support. She kept asking for more troops, more resources. The Abu Ghraib was right smack dab in the middle of a combat zone. Who decided to put it there? I don't know. Lots of issues in the case, lots of interesting issues, but what it all brought to a head was in May when that report came out. I didn't even get a chance to see it, didn't know it was coming on. Nobody bothered to tell her it was coming on. It told the story of Abu Ghraib. which was leaked to the media. And, of course, we don't know who leaked it. Those of us on the inside have our suspicions because we know who got the information first. But it became a huge media case. So the next day, she called me. And she had returned to the States. She had not been relieved of command. She had not been reprimanded like was recommended by General Taguba. Because I was going to get to the unfair part of the case. General Sanchez, rather than appoint a general officer to investigate all matters pertaining to what's in these photographs, sort of a broad scope, he said, conduct an inquiry into the shortcomings of the 800th MP Brigade, specifically her unit. And so when the 60 Minutes episode was on, the very next day, the Army came out with a statement saying, oh, yes, that's true. We do have this investigation going on. We were going to let you know about that later. But, yeah, we have these six children of Satan who we're prosecuting here, these soldiers. Oh, and the Army has relieved Brigadier General Janice Karpinski, naming her and only her, relieved her of her command and reprimanded her, neither of which were true. She was livid. She's absolutely livid. She called me and she said, Neil, what do we do about this? And I said, well, it looks like we need to set the record straight. It looks like we need to get the facts out before this goes spinning off in the wrong direction, because obviously they've picked you out to be holding the bag for this. And you'll read all about her theories about how high the bag is really being held, because she had access to a lot of information that she was never asked about in any of those hearings that we watched last summer. And I said, well, which network would you like to go on? I've got a Rolodex here of producers from that other case. And she says, well, I kind of like Diane Sawyer. She seems nice. Can you get me an interview with her? So I called ABC Good Morning America, talked to a producer there, Chris Francisconi, really nice guy. Francisconi, sounds like Connie Francis, only backwards. And the next day, both of us had plane tickets to New York. We were picked up in a limo, put up in a, and this is the way I recommend you do it, by the way. we were put up in a five-star hotel overlooking Central Park. We each had these gigantic suites. We were picked up in a limo next day and went down. We were on Good Morning America together, and then we went from studio to studio that whole day, her telling her story about what the truth was, about what really happened, about the fact that when all this occurred, she wasn't in command of Abu Ghraib anymore. The command had been transferred to a military intelligence brigade commander. Okay? And what was important about all that, what was important about access to the media and this media storm, was we were successful in, because we had this 15 minutes of fame surrounding her, she was able to spin, if you will, her side of the story. Because she was the only one who was willing to talk, because everybody else was under investigation. Immediately after we did that, within 2 weeks, all of the media coverage, all of the focus of future investigations was shifted to the military intelligence chain of command. The spotlight was off of her. Now, they continued to investigate her and everybody. I mean, there must have been 9 or 10 different investigations that came from the Taguba report. But understand that they were all based on the Taguba report, which was focused solely on her. General Taguba did not have license to look into other things that might have occurred there, and the fact that there was a confusing chain of command, and some of the troops didn't really know who they were supposed to take orders from and who they weren't. But the key issue here, I think, and subject for this panel is, what happens if you can't get the true information out? What happens if you can't be promised a kind of a confidentiality so that you can get the proper story out in the media? Now, it was important in the Al West case because it's like, I don't know if any of you saw that old movie back in the 80s, The Karate Kid. The famous Mr. Miyagi famously said, best defense, no be there. So the key is, if you can get the investigation or prosecution of your client turned off before you end up in a courtroom, you win. And that's because of all the list of things that can happen in a courtroom, 9 out of 10 of them are really bad. So if you can avoid the courtroom, my advice to the young embryonic lawyers, as was mentioned before, keep your clients out of the courtroom, because they run a much greater risk of bad things happening. So in Al West's case,
We went to an Article 32 investigation, which is a determination of whether there's sufficient evidence to have a court-martial, and we were able to convince the commanding general as a result of that to give him Article 15 non-judicial punishment and allow him to retire. He taught high school for a year and is now working for a defense contractor in Afghanistan, training Afghani military officers. So once again, in a sense, serving his country. General Karpinski is now Colonel Karpinski, retired. She successfully retired without any sort of prosecution or without any formal disciplinary action at all, although there's a statute that I didn't even know about. It applies to the reserves. I don't deal with the reserves that much. But apparently, in the statute that governs reserve general officers who are appointed are probationary for the first 180 days of their generalship. On day 179, no kidding, day 179, President Bush rescinded her star. I think she'll have something to say about that in her book, too. So she retired as a colonel. But, you know, it's interesting. A lot of people have different ideas, and people stand in different viewpoints. I'm certainly no constitutional law scholar. In fact, in terms of the intelligence level here, on this panel, I'm probably at that left lower end, but I like to play devil's advocate because I'm a defense lawyer. I like to kind of poke at things, and maybe if I could just to kind of poke at the panel here and poke at you all a little bit. I read about the Judith Miller case and I read about that whole fiasco. I read all the articles I possibly could, and from a lawyer's perspective, you know, had I been her lawyer, I don't know what I would have advised her, but I kind of remember something I learned in law school, and that is, and actually it's the reason why we're so concerned about the Roberts hearings and the hearings that will come later this year, is that when the Supreme Court says something, A, they mean it, and B, it's the last word. I mean, it really is the last word, unless there's some constitutional amendment that's passed, which is darn near impossible, to change that law. That Supreme Court announced law governs everything. So when I heard that, you know, that the Supreme Court had heard this issue that the professor just reminded us all about what the law is regarding, you know, how much power a special prosecutor has, how much power a grand jury has, and what is the privilege of journalists, and when you realize that the Supreme Court has said, well, there isn't one. There isn't a privilege. I mean, you can use whatever tactics you want to get somebody to talk to you, but you're not protected from something that none of the rest of us are protected from. I got to say, I don't feel sorry for Judith Miller at all. I mean, she's been visited by a lot of people. A lot more people than visit me. And she chose that. Now So she's not a martyr, let's put it that way. She's not a martyr. She knew what she was getting into. She chose to go where she's going, and she did it on principle. And I admire her for that. But I do not, for a single instant, feel sorry for her because she did not follow the law.
Well, Neil, in that regard,
none of us is above the law.
The D.C. Circuit said in its February 2005 decision, and I quote, "The highest court has spoken and never revisited the question. Without doubt, that is the end of the matter." So to me, at least, it was amazing that Floyd Abrams and others just went headlong into that buzzsaw.
Right.
Acting as if there was a First Amendment reporter's privilege, when in fact there wasn't.
Well, there's a reason for that. Just to take a quick digression.
Now we're going to hear from the journalist.
Well, and this is from a journalistic perspective. Brandsburg was a very interesting case for a whole lot of reasons, not the least of which was that mixed opinion. And what immediately happened when Brandsburg was decided was journalists interested in such matters, and a lot of them were and continue to be, read into it what they wanted to read into it. Surprised? You shouldn't be. A great many people who I admire, journalists and lawyers as well, read into Brandsburg a lot more than I think a fair reading ever put there. But because there were these little hints dropped about, well, you know, you could pass a shield law, which unfortunately at the time begged the question and begs it worse now. And that's what I find very interesting. There's been an evolution in the opinion among journalists about Brandsburg. I will make a confession right up front that I have always opposed, and when I represented journalists as the head of a professional association, I was very much out of step with most of my colleagues in First Amendment matters for opposing Scheel laws. I don't think they're a good idea, and the reason I don't think they're a good idea is not because I like seeing journalists get thrown into jail, but because eventually, and I think we've seen this happen, you bump up against that question of what the hell is a journalist? My sympathy for the court in the Brandsburg case has increased over the years. I thought it was just another, you know, goofy, impossible to comprehend opinion. Now I realize that they probably saw some of this coming and probably had a much tougher time writing those opinions than any of us have had reading them. So I would pose the question to basically everybody just quickly with respect to this notion of Scheel laws. We've heard sort of different opinions about it. Does it make any sense to question the whole notion of protecting a reporter's privilege by statute, understanding that someone has to decide who is and who isn't, and that was difficult in the early 1970s? I would argue it's impossible today, and therefore no Scheel law could ever work. We'll start with the Constitution.
Well, but as you know from what I said before, I think the logic of Landsberg has only grown much stronger over time because of the internet, which turns everybody into a potential Tom Paine or Publius. But just to abandon my own position for a second, though, it does seem to me that there is one strong argument on the other side, which is what does the Freedom of the Press Clause mean? The First Amendment specifies 6 different rights. There's free exercise, there's establishment, there's speech, there's press, there's assembly. Well, what does it mean to say freedom of the press? Because the way it's being interpreted is that it's perfectly synonymous with freedom of speech. So we read it in a way, certainly, that originalists would tell us we shouldn't read it, which is as pure surplusage. It's a redundancy. So I think that the Freedom of Press Clause at least has enough additional power that it would justify the passage of a Scheel law and immunize it against, say, an equal protection attack. Because that's the other problem. If you pass a Scheel law and you're a citizen who is being subpoenaed and you're not in the press, why can't you say, well, wait a second, why do the reporters have more of a right than I do to get out of it? But I think that the Freedom of Press Clause is at least strong enough there. An analogous example to that, I was at the Supreme Court a couple weeks ago, and I was brutally reminded that the press at the Supreme Court can bring in their notebooks and take notes. The Supreme Court bar and the unwashed public behind the Supreme Court bar cannot bring in a notebook and take notes, and they will snatch a notebook from your hand or kick you out of the room for having it. Well, it's not clear to me that that is necessarily constitutional. It looks a little bit like an equal protection violation, a First Amendment violation. At least I would want the Supreme Court to have to demonstrate a compelling interest for depriving the public of a right that has just been assigned to the press. On the other hand, it occurs to me, well, maybe that's the strength of the Freedom of Press Clause, that the government can assign certain privileges to the press that other people don't get necessarily. And you know, maybe you can make an argument about noise and rustling, the kind of thing that used to bother
the problem that, at least as I see it, that the court had to confront in Brandsburg was the degree to which the gathering of news was protected versus the publication. I mean, that's essentially what you're talking about, and that's essentially what the Judith Miller situation highlights so eloquently. She never published a word. She has all the freedom in the press in the world. She doesn't have the freedom, apparently, to gather the news. I think that's the conundrum that everybody has to face. And if I might just tell a story, because this really brought it home to me. I finally figured out in my own head what the insoluble problem of Brandsburg and this publish versus gather problem is. Some years ago now, I guess about 10 years ago, a law was proposed with great popular support to make inaccessible driver's license records. It was roaring through Congress almost unopposed because of kind of fundamental instincts and notions of privacy. And what was really driving it was the abortion debate, because what was happening, in fact, was that anti-abortion terrorists, for lack of a better term, were taking driver's license, license plate numbers and using open databases, public records, to cross-tabulate them with doctors working at abortion clinics who they would then proceed to kill. This was considered bad form. And there was a great hue and cry to pass a law that would seal those records. Well, the news media, not surprisingly, and this was print, broadcast, we were all in this game. There was a coalition of us that met over and over again to try and formulate a way to keep this law from being passed, to challenge this law. And guess what happened? After a couple of meetings, the proposal was, well, let's just carve out an exception for the news media. Okay, what are they? At that point, absolutists like me began to make ourselves scarce from the conversation. But here's what really brought it home. Somebody pointed out that anti-abortion groups publish newsletters. They're journalists. They could easily, if there's any fairness in the law, if there's any logic to the way a statute was written, they could easily claim that privilege. So what's the point? And at that point, a lot of us just gave up. It highlighted for me the problem that is really fundamental in the free press clause. It's impossible to define. It used to be easy, and we just kind of went along by intuition. It's not easy anymore. It wasn't logically at the time that Brandsburg was decided, except a number of us weren't bright enough to see that problem, whether those Supreme Court justices were prescient and were able to see into the future, I don't know. Most of them are dead now. But whatever it was they saw certainly came to pass. And so I, for one, have a brand new respect for Brandsburg, but also a diminishing affection for Shield laws, unfortunately. I believe the First Amendment. I'm sort of a Justice Black devotee. The First Amendment means what it says.
Don't
touch any of it.
Thank you, David. Let me bring up our last panelist, and I don't think there's any debate as to whether or not, if you want to know what a journalist is, let me introduce you to Ford Rowan, who is a former NBC News correspondent and who, in fact, covered probably the most famous trial of our time, the Watergate trial for NBC News. He now counsels clients who are in the eye of media storms, but I can't wait to hear his perspective, because what we've been hearing thus far, for the most part, of the perspective of lawyers. But here's somebody who every day had to go out and get stories and broadcast them all over the country, and I'm curious to see how he weighs in on the subject, particularly now that he's had some time to see all kinds of issues. He's also a lawyer.
Ford? Thank you.
Oh, by the way.
Thank you very much, Ron. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. I got a master's degree from American University in Government, so I'm glad to be back here. Although you got a great building. This is all new since I was here a million years ago. I've just kind of watched. You remember the story about the blind guys that touch the elephant, and they all come up with a different story about what the elephant is like because they can't see it, but touching different parts of it? Well, I've had the wonderful opportunity to see a bunch of different perspectives on this. I started as a news reporter a long time ago in New Orleans. My first day on the job, Hurricane Betsy hit New Orleans. And I thought about that last week. On Friday, I was back in New Orleans cleaning out what's left of my parents' apartment and looking at this hideous damage. But all the stuff that's coming out now, we did stories on that in the 1960s about the weakness of the levees and how it had broken in eastern New Orleans and could easily be the case throughout the city. So I guess things don't always change, but as a reporter, I did see this from one perspective. It was a very interesting one, and Ron mentioned Watergate. Also covered the CIA investigation, the investigation by congressional committees on the CIA and FBI alleged abuses. And during the course of that, I had a really good source at the CIA who wouldn't give me any new information, but was willing to meet with me and basically vet what I had learned. In other words, I would say, I'm thinking about doing a story about this, 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 and this. And he never failed me in terms of warning me off something that he thought was not right. And he never warned me off of something that was true. In other words, he never misled me. Now, I guess your right to privacy dies when you die. He was James Jesus Angleton, the head of counterintelligence. And having a source like that is in the benefit of the public, because what the public gets is accurate information, because there were a million rumors. There was all sorts of stuff. In fact, there were rumors, untruths spread by people with credibility, because they'd heard it from someone and they'd heard it from someone. And the story, the stuff that we heard about alleged abuses in these agencies that was wrong, in a lot of those cases that we were able to avoid having to spread falsehoods. So sometimes a source doesn't give you anything new, but can be the reality check for something. And I will always be indebted to him for having done that. Now, I'll give you another example, because I think examples help. Anybody remember the Glomar Explorer? This was a great ship that was out there that would dig up minerals from the bottom of the ocean. Well, actually, it was something that was cooked up for the CIA to try to lift up Soviet subs. And they found a Soviet sub that had been destroyed and in an accidental way, had been destroyed. And they were trying to retrieve the code books, machines that worked the codes, the secret codes, as well as nuclear weapons if they could get them. And they actually lifted up part of the submarine. They had a religious service by an Orthodox priest to bury the dead. And we wanted to get the videotape of all of this, but before the story ever became public, we never did get it, incidentally. Before the story ever became public, it was known by guys like me, and we were urged by the agency, don't use these stories, please, there's no reason to do this. And in fact, there didn't seem to be a good reason to do it, but we all ran the story the same day that Drew Pearson, Jack Anderson, revealed it in one of his columns. Once one guy breaks the sort of unwritten rule about, gee, is there any newsworthiness to this, then everyone jumped on it. Maybe in retrospect it sounds more newsworthy than it did at the time. A third example that might be interesting to you has to do with the Iranian hostage crisis, when militants in Iran seized the American embassy there and held hostage a lot of American citizens. NBC did not report what it knew, which was that some American embassy personnel were hiding in the Canadian embassy, and didn't reveal that until they were safely out of Iran. So there are times when the relationship between reporters and their sources serves the public interest in ways that aren't immediately apparent until you sort of dig into it. Some of my best sources were actually at a very obscure government agency called the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. And in 1975, we did the story I'm most proud of all of them was the first story on the ARPANET, which today is known as the Internet, and which was used at the time to move files of dissidents from place to place. And also, there were enormous security and privacy issues that had not yet surfaced and have only recently, well, in the last 15 years, become obvious. But at the time, it was just sort of a new area. And we're now in that age, the age of interconnectivity. And it really makes a very different game, as some of the panelists have mentioned. I've also seen this from the perspective of someone that taught journalism for 13 years, part-time at Northwestern University. I've seen it from the perspective of someone who practiced communications law for a while, for 4 years, and then got into the consulting business because companies kept wanting to hire me because they got in trouble. And so for the last bunch of years, what I've done is tried to help companies that were pariahs, innocent pariahs, but pariahs, people that had oil spills in pristine areas, people that had SUVs that rolled over at inopportune times,
drug companies that had side effects for their antidepressant drugs or their arthritis remedies, companies that had six refinery and chemical plant explosions, those sorts of things. Mad cow disease was that. We even had a restaurant chain that hired us on mad cow disease. If you go to our website, you'll find none of their names, because our MO is keep it quiet if we can. So I think I can count the number of times that we've leaked stuff to the press on one hand. And we've done some pretty big cases. In fact, 10 of the 20 largest companies in the United States are our clients. So we've discretion and quiet has been successful there, trying to keep it out of the press if possible. So this media storm you hear so much about won't confound the way you operate. But that's not the easiest thing to do. What usually happens is information becomes ammunition in the wars, the policy wars or the prosecutorial wars. We work with two of the first companies convicted of environmental crimes. Okay, now you can look them up and figure out who they were. But in so doing, what we discovered is several things which I think can be applicable to news organizations themselves. Okay, now these rules were written for people who are worried about regulation, litigation, news media, and all the rest. So I'm going to give you just a few of them really quick. But if you ever get into the business of advising corporate clients, this might be useful to you. The first is reality counts. You will find in your clients denial, and I think that's true in the news media as well. How could this be happening to us? We're the newspaper of record. Well, wait a minute. It can happen to any company. Good things happen, bad things happen, sometimes in a random way, and sometimes because you've got agents, people that work for you, that do strange things. So first of all, figure out what is really the case, what's happening. Second, get smart. A lot of these companies do not have an in-house capability to deal with a crisis. That's fine. You need a dispassion view anyway, and it really helps to bring in people like you see sitting here who can help with that outside perspective. Third, get strategic. What is the overriding interest? What is the goal that you want to have accomplished at the end of a bad process if you're on the receiving end of this kind of attention? That sounds so easy, but it's so hard to get them to articulate that. I mean, if it's maintained, I had one client, it was an environmental a company with an environmental problem. There were over 150 lawsuits against them. Personal liability, question of getting sick, getting ill for a pesticide. And a lead attorney for the outside law firm that they'd hired, a very good law firm, told the CEO in one meeting, he said, "We're winning all these cases. We're winning one after another. We've got a great record. We're only settling the nuisance cases. We're winning." And the CEO said in almost a whisper, "Yeah, but I lost the product. I lost the product," and it was his cash cow product. And it made a big difference, and that company doesn't exist anymore. It got bought up and swallowed up by someone bigger. Fourth objective, improve. Hey, listen, you know, there are always ways you can get better at what you do and be on the side of the angels. If you're a polluter, you might try polluting less. My clients don't like hearing this, but it is indeed the best advice. If you're a news organization, you might really ask yourself, whose interests are we helping right now? Is it the source? Is it the news staff, or is it the public's right to know? And I think you can make a case for that, but you have to be careful how you do it. Fifth, focus. There are times to fight. There are times to settle. There are times to run away, as the song says. No one to hold them and fold them. And in this case, focusing on what the risks are. For example, I think the Time magazine reporter that got his source to agree to let him, you know, reveal his name, or who is off the hook because of it. That's an example of a good way to focus on this. What is the best way to navigate a problem? Sixth, target. Who do you care about the most? And in this case, the news media. I've got to say, I love the press, but they have their arrogance. The fact that so many people think they're elitist is a great detriment. Their ability to persuade people of the necessity for privilege for reporters who receive confidential information.
Seventh, calibrate. Okay? First, do no harm. Don't make your case worse. A lot of companies that I've worked for are tempted to take out full-page ads. I am not a crook, these ads will say. It has about the same effect saying that had for Richard Nixon. People say, oh, maybe they are, you know? Which is what Aristotle warned against, called the implication of the opposite. Never imply the opposite of what you want to get across by the choice of words. To state it in the negative, I'm not a child molester. True statement, but you started to wonder, didn't you? So you got to be careful how you say things. And lawyers are the worst for this, incidentally, because of the way you're trained. So you state the allegation and deny it. Well, great, except when you're on TV. Eighth, get allies. And here the press has also been notoriously poor in trying to defend itself. It looks like, well, they're those arrogant elitists that are trying to protect their own little area. But the public needs to be informed as to what the stakes are in these kinds of cases. And ninth, and I think this is really an important one, the whole idea, this really ought to be rule number one, accuracy is what's important. And I think I can judge the accuracy of what I read better if I know the motives of the people that are propounding it. I think it does make a difference if it's Karl Rove. Maybe we don't know it's a fact in the Joe Wilson case. And I'm not in the Joe Wilson case, okay? I know Wilson and talk with him, but I'm not advising him. But if it is the president's political operative, and that's an important piece of information for me to assess the credibility of anything that I read in a column. And I think as a reader, as part of the public, I would like to know more about where this information I read every day is coming from. And I think the press has had far too much reliance on confidential sources. It's been, from Watergate on, it's been that way. In fact, Watergate glamorized the use of a confidential source, this deep throat stuff. Okay? My hero in this town actually is a graduate of American University, if I recall correctly, I.F. Stone. I know he taught here anyway. I.F. Stone said, go to the documents. Go to the documents. You'll find what you need in the record. It's there. And in fact, when I was a national security correspondent for NBC News, it was fun to read this stuff because in there was all this tidbits. I remember reading something that was highly redacted, and I got through it. It was a defense appropriations hearing. And I get through it, and I said, Jesus, they're working on a death ray. And it was a great story when I went out to the Sandia labs in New Mexico and had them show me their laser guns and their particle beam stuff before they realized that the Pentagon might not exactly appreciate that we were talking about it. Those things are there, and when reporters rely too heavily on sources, and they do in this town, this is an incestuous town, and Bob Novak may be the worst of the whole bunch, but this is an incestuous relationship, and it's part of the reason people don't trust the press. Anyway, my rant is over.
Ford, I wonder if you'd comment on, you raised a really fascinating point, which we should talk about a little, and that is when you're looking at a newspaper column and you have to make a judgment about its credibility, you have to ask yourself the question, what's the reason for the column? Is it newsworthy? Is he serving a source? Is, for example, in the Novak column, is he doing this as payback or because he wants to have an open line to the White House for future leaks? I think most people who are not journalists, when they read opinion pieces, don't calculate all those things in their mind. They read the piece. They don't think of every possible angle that you just talked about. I wonder if you'd comment on that.
We need to be better consumers of the news, okay? We really do need to be, and one of the ways you can do that is to assess the credibility. A lot of people see something on the Internet and assume it must be true. How can you imagine that people would do that? But they do. And in this case, what we've got is a situation where, and it's true in every White House, they're the favorites. They get the stories. They get the leaks. They get the information first. They get to write a column about it. They get the color so they can stick it in there, and it looks a little different from what people have already seen on CNN or whatever. And in fact, the danger to reporters, if you ever represent reporters, the danger to reporters is they get co-opted. And you're sitting there saying, hey, if I write a really nasty story about the White House and it's botched this or that, the people at the White House that I rely on for my daily feeding are going to be less likely to give me the steak, you know, and potatoes. They're much more likely to give me, you know, the MREs.
Afternoon newsflash. leaking in Washington isn't new, and the motives for leaking and the motives for being someone who is leaked to are not new either. They long predated Watergate. But I'd like to loop that notion, which I don't hear anybody protesting, back to what we talked about earlier. One of the problems in making value judgments in the first place, or God forbid, legal judgments based on those value judgments in assessing leaking, is the assessment of good leaks and bad leaks. Who decides that a particular leak is in the public interest? Karl Rove, not to be his defender here, but I bet you he could make a rather eloquent case for, if in fact he was the person who spoke to Bob Novak, for why it was a good thing to do it, apropos of some of the things Ford said. And I think that without making that value judgment on my own authority, I think we do need to appreciate and maybe think down a couple of layers of the onion. I'd be interested in what other people have to think about that, about how you make those judgments. Where you stand often depends on where you sit, and if the leak is good for you, then it's in the public interest. If it happens to be inconvenient for you or your client, then it's not in the public interest. And as a kind of overall notion, to pick up on something Ford alluded to, the rules of evidence in the court of public opinion are very different. The rules of procedure in the court of public opinion are very different than those in a court of law. And that's often the roadblock or often the speed bump that folks playing both sides of the game get hung up on. They think that a reporter will follow nice, tidy legal protocols when most reporters can't spell protocol.
So at the end of the day, do any of you think that the fact that Judith Miller is sitting in jail as we're speaking is going to have a chilling effect on gathering the news?
Well, before we answer that question, can we back up for a second?
Sure.
You know,
sure.
The president said when this leak became really public, we're going to get to the bottom of this. And he later said, I don't think we'll ever get to the bottom of this. But one thing is clear. Had he gotten to the bottom of this, and it's not that hard. All he had to do was walk down the hall.
Right.
Now, Bob Novak said two senior administration officials. Judith Miller would not be in jail. So if you have to blame anybody, people are blaming Pat Fitzgerald for being so aggressive in going after Judy Miller. People are blaming Floyd Abrams for running into the buzzsaw. If you have to blame anybody, you blame the administration for not investigating who leaked the information. And this is where, David, I really do part company with you, because I don't think Karl Rove in a million years can justify doing what he did.
Mm-hmm.
And we as consumers of news couldn't justify it. If the administration wanted to attack Joe Wilson and discredit him, they could have come out and said, for attribution, his report is not to be believed for the following reasons. They didn't do that. They said, in fact, the 16 words shouldn't have been in the State of the Union. And they could have said his assignment wasn't authorized, his assignment was engineered by his wife, or what have you. Made that statement, confronted him, confronted the agency on the record so we as consumers could evaluate what their motives are and why they were saying those things. They didn't say that. They insinuated it by leaking it to a conservative columnist, hoping that it would seep out and slime Joe Wilson.
I'd get in trouble sounding like I was defending Karl Rove.
There's no public interest for that, and it really does highlight why confidential sources are not in our interests as consumers of the news. Al Newhart, who founded USA Today, banned anonymous sources at USA Today. He said there are sources who are cowards who tell more than they know. You know, if you don't have to be responsible for what you say, you can say anything for any reason about anybody. So, you know, my one takeaway, I don't have a great list like Ford's, but my one takeaway is distrust anonymous sources, protect them when they're necessary, and the press should be able to use them, but they should be used exceedingly sparingly.
Well, the trouble with that, I mean, that's a perfectly rational notion until it's sort of like Brandsburg, until you come up against the problem of retrospection. Let's talk about James Angleton. Retrospectively, everything he told you was true. And I guess by implication, at least, you made an argument that his leaks to you, probably right on the edge of, of violating the laws, even as they existed then, were in the public interest.
I don't think he violated any law.
Okay.
I think he was very careful not to.
Was he in? Was what he was doing in the public interest?
I think he was. I mean, if you believe in accuracy, you know, my biggest concern at the time was, is this man misleading me? Okay? I mean, it wouldn't be very hard to do. I'm just a reporter. I don't know shit from Shinola, to be blunt about it. Two people tell me it's true, I've got enough, I can go with it. I mean, hey, you know, and I got burned once on this, once really badly, when we said Butterfield was a CIA agent in the White House. That was a frigging lie. And the one source that said it lied, and the second source that corroborated it, had heard it from the first source. But I never connected the dots till too late. Okay? So I confess I've screwed up being source dependent at that. But we outed it, but it was not an anonymous source. Mm-hmm. The liar was interviewed on camera. That's my escape there. I plead guilty, but I don't, you know, you can say, well, he shouldn't have talked to the reporters and all this other stuff, but it's a Washington game. He was trying to manage the news, but instead of, he realized if he lied, his value as a source would immediately go away. So he was smart enough not to do that. There are some people in this town that are absolutely great about that. Most reporters don't talk about them because they're the kind of guys that don't want, they're not leaking dirt. That happens. But I'm talking about the people that actually give you correct information and really warn you when you've got it wrong. Because reporters, no matter how smart they are, never know as much as the guys who are actually doing the real work. Okay? So if I'm talking to somebody that's planning on what we're going to do in the next pandemic, okay, they're going to know more than I would as a reporter, no matter how smart I am, and even if I'm one of those reporters that has an MD, okay, because they're in the middle of working the problem. And maybe I can get a lot of different sources and get a new perspective that any single individual who's a source may not have. But I really believe that there are people out there that do a great deal of service to the public by being willing to talk to the press. But I agree wholeheartedly this business about anonymous sources who slime people, that's a Washington tradition, and reporters ought to wake up to it and the public ought to be warned against it. And one of the ways you can protect yourself from misinformation is to know the source of it. And good news professionals try to tell you, even if they do keep confidentiality, try to indicate where the information came from to give you some mm-hmm. clue about the source. Now, I see others itching to talk.
Well,
so
I think I'm agreeing with what you just said. I'm rather charmed by the notion that just because someone says something on the record that they're telling the truth after Vietnam and Watergate and Iraq and so on. So I think we have to remain agnostic on the claim that people are more likely to tell the truth if they're speaking in public than if they're off the record in deep background. And I think the reporter should be as skeptical as he or she can be, and we should all be skeptical about what we're reading. But I do think that we can legalize leaking only to a very narrow extent, which is when there really is a national security interest of the gravest sort at stake. And even there, I think the Supreme Court was absolutely right in the Ellsberg case, in the Pentagon Papers case, to say, look, all that's happening is, you know, Ellsberg is putting information out there that doesn't deal with the future. It deals with the past. It deals with how we got into Vietnam. And that should be a question for public discussion and public debate. And so if Rove gets tripped up here, it's precisely because he violated a very narrow rule that applies to a very narrow band of people about outing people who are intelligence agents.
I need to put a footnote on this because I realize that I'm an old guy. The guy I was talking about who was the CIA guy in the White House, but he really wasn't, was a White House aide who revealed the existence of Nixon's taping system that eventually led to Nixon's downfall because there were his own words on the tape. Okay, so that's why that was an important piece of information that I thought I ought to put a footnote on.
He told the truth in private. He lied in public.
Well, no, ultimately he told the truth in public too. But I want to tie something back, get everybody's opinion. You heard Neil talk about the Taguba report and the fact that it was leaked. And we'll just start right at the end. Professor, was that a good leak or a bad leak if you were a Supreme Court justice having to write an opinion defending that or not?
But I would say it's a good leak, because my inclination is that in a democracy, public information, information within the realm of government, should be presumptively available to the people, unless you can demonstrate a compelling national security reason, you know, military troop movements or something like that, then the people should have access to it.
But big parts of it were classified.
Yeah. Well, this is a trend we've been seeing in the Bush administration.
That's a violation of the law.
You know, I think it was a good leak, but if there's a prosecution, the defense ought to be it was improperly classified. I mean, people who leak do so at their peril. They're patriots very often. Daniel Ellsberg was a patriot. He ran the risk of going to jail, and if he did, he understood that that was a risk. But the press should be able to report it, but there also should be consequences if ultimately it's determined that a law's been broken.
Neil, you agree?
It was improperly classified, and it was only small portions that were classified, but I think it was a good leak. I think it was information that needed to come to public attention, but I believe the process that the Army had in place, it was going to become public at some point anyway. The leaking just got it out more quickly. So as far as whether it's good or bad, we would have known it eventually anyway.
So even though your specific client was imperiled by that leak, as you described it, unless I misunderstood you, you would still argue for the higher purpose that it was a good leak.
Well, yes. And
good in quote.
Well, a good leak. She was imperiled by it, but she wasn't imperiled by the report itself. She was imperiled by the misrepresentation about what was in the report by the Army.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Ford?
Well, let me... I think that I've got to say something about what Chris said. I think this is absolutely correct. The real problem, and it's a shame that Judith Miller is sitting in a jail right now, the real problem is that this administration, the White House, has not been transparent about what happened. That is the real outrage. And we can talk about all these other outrages that we may truly believe in, but that's the one that really we ought to focus on. Why is she in jail? It's because this business about we're going to reveal all and get to the bottom of it has not happened at the highest level.
Can I just ask one question about that? What puzzles me is why is she still in jail when Matt Cooper has already outed Rove as the source of the leak? Why doesn't she...
Well, there were two sources, you recall.
Uh-huh.
Novak said two senior administration officials. A lot of people speculate that it was Scooter Libby, who is Cheney's chief of staff. There is also speculation that there's a perjury investigation going on, and she may have information that bears on that, or obstruction of justice. It's not at all clear, because the D.C. Circuit's opinion is highly redacted, but it is very significant that it was a unanimous decision, and all the judges found that the subpoenas to her and to Matt Cooper should be enforced because the information is so pertinent. So we're all dying to know why she's in jail.
But the real answer to your question is nobody knows. That's the great mystery. I mean, now that Deep Throat has been revealed, it's all we got left. Hopefully it won't take 30 years to find out the answer to that, but it's a big unanswered question. It's a strange, strange set of circumstances, and it really won't be sorted out until, I guess, until Judith Miller's out of jail,
right,
and the grand jury report.
The little fill-up on this is that a lot of people view Judith Miller as the administration's favorite. That she may have been working. She certainly worked in tandem with him in reporting on the events leading up to the war, and who knows what her involvement was. So it's not at all a clear-cut case.
The smart money seems to be, I mean, just to engage in a little speculation, the smart money seems to be that it's probably not what anybody thinks it is, that it's not just the name of that second source, that we're miles past that. That it might be perjury, it might be some nefarious involvement that she had on broader matters with the White House. The notion that the White House is keeping her in jail may be off base or maybe on base. We just don't know. It's a great mystery. It'll keep people busy for a while. She'll write a book out of it, I'm sure.
I promised all of you that you'd have a chance to question some of our panelists. Let me just take this opportunity to thank them all for coming. We're going to have a reception in the Dean's Suite, which is on the third floor, immediately following. And so if you're all invited to come up for refreshments, and you could question all the panelists that you want face-to-face then. And I didn't want to interrupt. The flow was moving so well. I didn't want to stop it to get questions from the floor. But I suggest we do that upstairs. And I just want to close with my favorite Dave Bartlett story, because Ford Rowan said you have to be an important consumer of the news. And I want to close with the story. My favorite Dave Bartlett story is it was a time when Dave was running something called the NBC TalkNet. Am I right? Was it called NBC TalkNet? And he's up at 30 Rockefeller Center in New York running this vast radio network. And I was up there one day and we had lunch. And he was literally pulling his hair out. He said, I have somebody on the air every day that's listened to by, I don't know, it could be millions of people, giving out psychology advice that has no training at all in psychology. He said, I have somebody on the air who's giving out legal advice and economic advice that has no training in economics or in the law. And he said,
welcome to the
media. Who's your president?
I'm not going to mention the names because you would all know the names. Some of them went on to become television personalities. But here he was running this network of people who basically, the only qualification they really had for being on the air was that they were good communicators. They had no training in anything they were talking about. They were just wonderful communicators. And so I think sometimes when we're flipping around and watching cable news and things along those lines, you have to think real carefully about what are the qualifications of the people that are talking, because usually, I mean, Dave's criteria was, and he was lamenting the fact, is you have to sound good on the air. He said, what good is it if I had the greatest economist in the world who had a PhD from Harvard if he couldn't communicate on the air and people were turning off? Has that changed, by the way, Dave, since we had that lunch? Do you find that more and more people are on the air because they're great communicators or because...
if anything, it's worse. No,
hey, when Dave and I left, the standards went to hell.
Oh, listen.
Right. Thank you all for coming. You're all invited up to the Dean's Suite on the third floor. Thank you.